give thanks and praises. Bob Marley and the Wailers, give thanks and praises. One of my most favorite prayer songs. If Jah didn't love I, would I be around today? Would I be around to say, welcome, Travis?
Thank you.
Thanks for being here in the cab with me, Dream Queen, on KMRD LP. We're here in the book club, and we're going to talk about Khalil Gibran's The Prophet on Prayer. And I just kind of want to dive right in. I mean,
you're going to read it right off the bat.
I just want to read it right off the bat.
Just read it.
Ooh, I just want to share it. It's so good.
Let it out.
It's so good. All right, everybody. As you know, we're in this, or as you don't know, if you're not familiar with The Prophet, Mustafa, he sees his ship after he's been chilling in Orphalese, minding his business on the hill, but also checking out the people. And it's time for him to leave that island that he's been in for exile. And he makes his way down to the shore. And the people follow him. And they say, don't go. And he said, I gotta go. And Almitra comes out of the temple and meets them all in the square near the seawall. And she says, while we wait for your ship to dock, we know we can't keep you here, but would you please share your wisdom and your observations with us, that we may share them with our children and them with theirs, and these wisdoms, the knowing of us, humanity, may never die. And he says, aye. And so people come up and ask him to speak on a topic, one after the other. And we've been through it all the way up to prayer. Then a priestess said, speak to us of prayer. And he answered, saying, you pray in your distress and in your need. Would that you might pray also in the fullness of your joy and in your days of abundance. For what is prayer but the expansion of yourself into the living ether? And if it is for your comfort to pour your darkness into space, it is also for your delight to pour forth the dawning of your heart. And if you cannot but weep when your soul summons you to prayer, she should spur you again and yet again, though weeping, until you shall come laughing. When you pray, you rise to meet in the air those who are praying at that very hour, and whom save in prayer you may not meet. Therefore, let your visit to that temple invisible be for naught but ecstasy and sweet communion. For if you should enter the temple for no other purpose than asking, you shall not receive. And if you should enter into it to humble yourself, you shall not be lifted. Or even if you should enter into it to beg for the good of others, you shall not be heard. It is enough that you enter the temple invisible. I cannot teach you how to pray in words. God listens not to your words, save when he himself utters them through your lips. And I cannot teach you the prayer of the seas and the forests and the mountains. But you who are born of the mountains and the forests and the seas can find their prayer in your heart. And if you but listen in the stillness of the night, you shall hear them saying in silence, our God, who art our winged self, it is thy will in us that willeth. It is thy desire in us that desireth. It is thy urge in us that would turn our nights, which are thine, into days, which are thine also. We cannot ask thee for aught, for thou knowest our needs before they are born in us. Thou art our need, and in giving us more of thyself, thou givest us all. Travis. Khalil Gibran, the prophet, on prayer. You blinking them back. I see you today. You blinking them back.
I got a little something in my eye.
I know. Oh, I was like, I'm going to be the one. I'm going to be the one weeping today. Hey. Yes. Yes.
I feel like a lot of his poetry speaks to the paradox. You know, how we see it. And if we don't understand the opposite of it. You know, I grew up in a house that, you know, you were told to pray over every bad thing that could ever happen to you. Like, that's the thing that you do in those times. But it never really, like, hit me until I heard the patterns repeating too many times that when a prayer has the same words over and over and over again, it started to feel performative to me, and there was an awkwardness to it. So, you know, I always felt strange about prayer when I was young. You'd get picked on at the table to say the prayer. That was like always my, I was freaking afraid of that. You know what I mean? And I'd be at a table with 10 people and they're just like, all right, would you give the blessing?
Yeah, get a blessing.
No, I'm not prepared. Or you'd be like, you know, this anxiety beforehand, like, what am I going to say? What am I, you know what I mean? Like, performative in a way. But I don't know why we don't see, like, laughing as prayer or just the feeling, being in the moment, like, that it has to have a sound or that it has to come with a sensation. That's the human condition, you know? But I feel like our higher selves exist outside of our senses. And we feel it. We want to be a part of it. And that's a way in our minds that we can meet it halfway.
Yes, I feel like the duality, the complexity of our avatars, the meat suit, the body. You know, sometimes I feel like I'm just in here driving a machine, right? And then there's the conditioning of society that influences how we might care for our meat suit.
Mm-hmm.
And we have to integrate the rules of a man-made society. And then that involves dulling some of the senses, that sixth sense that you and I were talking about before we came on the air. Sometimes getting caught up in this rigmarole of work, family, the material existence doesn't leave room to be inside of our elevated mind until maybe right before sleep. And even then, some people got folks in bed with them. Or, you know, either a person in another meat suit or your phone or whatever it is, you know.
Well, we were talking yesterday about always thinking about the well when the well is full, you know. And then after that, I went and had like a coffee at the refinery, was staring at this mountain maple that I was sitting next to. And there's a woodpecker working on its third hole. And I'm thinking, it's doing the same thing we're doing. It's thinking one is good, two is better, three must be fantastic. You know what I mean? And then it reminded me of another poem about how he says that comfort enters your house as a guest and leaves as a master. You know what I mean? And the paradox that the prayer poem is talking about, like praying when you're feeling in your highest vibration, that's probably when it's the most powerful or actually doing something, because it becomes like music, vibration, harmonics, those things. But the paradox, like we want to be more comfortable, more seems to be better in our minds because of you know, it's even in nature.
Well, that woodpecker got to eat, right? Is he drilling holes to find the bugs? Is that what he's
doing?
No, he's making
holes big enough to get into.
Okay.
It's probably because part of the tree is hollow.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, maybe he needs a front door, a back door, side door, you know, whatever.
He need a room for the kids. You got a spring tower. You got to put the nest and you get him a little lady to come in there and have some little eggs.
No, but isn't that the thing? The thing that gives us the joy comes from a certain amount of sorrow. You know, the paradox. It's like the poem on love where he talks about, you know, in your fear, you would seek only love's peace and love's pleasure. Then it would be better that you cover your nakedness and pass out of love's threshing floor.
Yes.
Into the seasonless world where you shall laugh, but not all of your laughter, and weep, but not all of your tears. The paradox in the prayer, you know, like if you could imagine raising the vibration of a room because everybody is in it, and all you want is to try to find the harmonics that try to, you know, lift the vibration of a room. I think we all understand what that is. You know, when music is right, the scene is right, everybody is, you know, you've seen it happen where everyone's just in a joyous mood, and it almost seems like a magic. If you step back, it has a color. It, you know, there's...
Yes, and I feel like I'd like to become a living prayer. Have you ever heard of that?
Yeah.
To exist in that vibration. And boy, is it exhausting. It is very exhausting to make the transition, to be ever mindful of my vibration. Now, it will become habitual in a state of being, but as we know, to make a change, it involves extension. Expansion of oneself into the living ether, like expanding, that's an output of energy
mm-hmm.
that to transcend the mundaneness. The other thing that I wanted to say was close to where you were going about being in a room and having the vibration lifted and the joyousness that can be a part of that, and the joy that is in sorrow. There's another poem in here called Joy and Sorrow. And I think about sitting with people and counseling with people who are in grief. Here it is on page 32 of my little teeny book. The woman says, "Speak to us of joy and sorrow. The selfsame well from which your laughter rises was oftentimes filled with your tears. And how else can it be? The deeper that sorrow carves into your being, the more joy you can contain. Is not the cup that holds your wine the very cup that was burned in the potter's oven?" Right? And I might not necessarily be able to take away someone's sorrow, but to be present with them and hold that the vibration of divinity, of the union, of taking away that duality and bringing it all back to the oneness that we are,
mm-hmm.
that our experiences are, my love and my sorrow are the same exact feeling.
Right. We have more in common with those that we don't like. Than we do with those that would like. You know, the paradoxes are crazy. And we can feel so sure of ourselves. But if we don't do the devil's advocate work, the dark side work, and say, is there something in this that I'm not seeing? Is it connected to something that happened to me? You know, something like that. And when I was young, dealing with the Southern Baptist as a religion, not really understanding, feeling very cringy, awkward around that. When I went to Jamaica and tried to experience, you know, where people were at with that, they were doing a lot of work with word sound power, they called it. that's why you hear I and I a lot in reggae. It's trying to see another person as yourself. And the language barrier that we have is crazy. I mean, trying to describe any of the things that goes through the mind, it's like the work of a poet or a linguist. You know, you have to have good vocabulary to really wrap your mind around it. The more words we have, the more ways we have to try to connect.
When you were talking about I and I, it made me think of namaste. And my research lately into some of the teachings of Sadhguru, and he did a very, like, it was a very brief snippet that I saw on the word namaste. And there's a literal translation is I bow to you. And the gesture that comes with the two palms meeting in the center of your solar plexus or your heart chakra is to take two seemingly disparate parts and make them one. And the idea is I bow to that in you, which is in me. I bow to the divinity in us both. Let that which is apart become one. And in our American society right now, in the commodification of everything, namaste among a lot of people that I know, it's a joke. They're just like, oh, the namaste yoga pants, you know, Whole Foods, excuse me, crowd. The commodification of yoga, the taking, just making it a thing that the rich, the elite can participate in at their leisure. I find myself trying to unlearn a lot of the snark that's been placed on spirituality. And I find myself, sadly, having held back some of my growth because to fit in with the crowd. But I would love to walk around and put my palms together and, you know, bring them together at my heart chakra and bow to that which is within me, that is within the person I'm meeting. Because it gives a pause. It really does allow me to pause and say, whatever came before now, whatever came before this moment, it's clean. Because I see myself in you. Exactly yes. What you were saying.
Yeah, it's like taking off the rose-colored glasses and just putting on some clear glasses for a second. Like, I can have some feelings about characters that come into town, but I can also play devil's advocate in my own mind and just be like, you know, I don't really know anything about these people. They could be completely opposite of what I'm perceiving. And if I don't check myself, we start trying to form patterns, put people into groups, categorize everything around us, because that's kind of what we do. I mean, we're looking for patterns in life so that we can avoid things that we don't want to be around or be around. But also that's keeping us from connection and a lot of other things. So we'll think of it as, oh, this is probably a good habit. Maybe I don't hang around with or at a certain area with certain types, or I do this, or, you know, keep it safe and play it safe. The opposite of that is you just disconnected yourself with everybody.
I firmly believe in protecting one's energy, I have to say. It's another frequently used term in reggae is the vampire.
Right, but it's important and it isn't, just like this conversation we're having. You know what I mean? If you don't put that through your mind, then you end up on a, you know, because we're talking about extremes, right? In love, in prayer, we're talking about the heights and the low ends. And that's always where we're at, pushing those two limits. And anytime we're in the middle, we seem bored, you know. And I think that in my mind, even as it comes out of my mouth, I'll say, that can feel true in the moment. And it probably also isn't, you know, because it doesn't relate to everybody. Just like we're talking about yoga being an affluent kind of a thing to do, or Whole Foods shopping. You know, when you are making that kind of money, and you live next to Whole Foods, it makes sense. You know, if you're a parent, it might make some sense. Trying to connect to different cultures, that makes sense. So it can be silly and it can be not silly. it can be important, more important than we think, or maybe it's nothing at all. You know,
what are you really mad at when you're mad at these things, right? What am I really reacting to? I'm not reacting to the existence of natural food. I'm reacting to the fact that it's priced out of everyone's ability to attain it. And so those mm-hmm. who can't go there due to financial restrictions are forced to eat trash and garbage, literally plastic mm-hmm. and poisonous food. And then the well-off who can afford the natural things, right? It's so weird. It's right. like, no, why? This, how do you need so much money to get what comes out of the earth? Right. And then you look down your nose at the people who can't be there. You know, some people do, you know, and they say, well, you know, I mean, it's pervasive in our culture right now. And the, you know, the elite just have access to life.
It's a lot of stigma around money. Like, I have to admit that I would be embarrassed to show my food cupboard to most people because, you know, nobody knows what my situation is like. And when I was making a lot of money, I had kids. Of course, I was trying to buy the best food on the planet for them. And so that type of store traps people like me right into that cycle. You know, but, you know, backtracking to the stigma, it becomes an issue when you feel like you're being judged by other people. You know, oh, I saw you at Walmart. Didn't know you shopped over there. Or you might feel a way about, but when you're in survival mode or you're close to the bottom, you just get a different experience. That's how I see it. I'm not like mad about my social position. In fact, the other day I had the weirdest quote come out of my mouth. It was like, it wasn't a quote. It was me. It was, I can't afford to be rich where I'm at right now. I can't afford that.
Say more.
Because I feel like it would take me out of my path that I'm on right now, which I'm enjoying, you know. I also feel like I don't know of a lot of examples in the patterns I've seen in life where people don't dramatically change and get dulled down by that comfort entering the house like that as a guest and then leaving as the master. Certain amount of hunger is a drive for me. And, you know, maybe I could be smarter and have the drive be something else. But someone told me a story of this well-to-do artist. Not well-to-do, because every time he sells an art piece, he instantly buys something stupid with all of the money so that he can be right back in the spot where he feels like he needs to drive that art piece, the next one. And there's something to that. I mean, but for me, like when I have excess money, I have extra time because I feel like I've discovered how much I'm important. Like it's almost like you take that extra money and you hire yourself to not do anything for a minute or do what you want or just allow yourself to be in that mode of what do I want to do. And then work is different on that end when you choose it. You know, labor can be rough. I mean, you and I doing labor yesterday. Yeah. A lot of work to do that's not super exciting. But when you're in the flow and you're doing your art, whatever it is, it's the same labor, but it feels effortless.
So I'm going to bring it back to prayer because I've shirked off my vow of poverty. I'm done. I'm done. No, because I used to share a similar value system and I was brought up Southern Baptist. My family was not well-to-do, but definitely working class and had enough. And we still have enough, but it is still a struggle to make it. My grandfather was an assistant pastor at the Baptist church in a very well-off neighborhood. It was across town, Georgetown in D.C., one of the last predominantly black churches in the area over there. My grandmother was a missionary and assistant pastor's wife. We very active in the church. Got called on to say the blessing quite often and memorized quite a few things. And it does become rote. And at the same time, I would like to get back to praying over my food, my water, everything that I'm about to put into my body. Because as God, I hate to say this, as science has caught up with spirituality in doing the visions, the pictures of the water molecules and how they change as a result of the interactions that we have with them, the water crystals and things like this, we can see how talking to a glass of water changes the molecular structure in a way. And then we put it in. So if I'm sitting there watching, like, you know, Jason versus Freddy, and I'm drinking this soda that's been sitting in front of the speaker, and then I'm taking in not only the information that's coming to my brain from the movie, but then the vibes that are going into my snacks and everything like that, you know, all of that is getting integrated into my energetics, right? So if I remember to give thanks and praises for every single thing I take in, even the sun salutation in the morning to say, thank you for this sun and the light, it keeps me grounded so that in my abundance, I am connected to the wellspring of wealth that is there for all of us. And then I become a tool of giving. If I'm in a scarcity mindset, if I'm in a place of, if I give this person this $5, I'm not going to have any more. I don't know where my next $5 is going to come from. But if I stay in a place of gratitude and blessed, like that I'm blessed, I know that it doesn't matter. It's going to come. Now that might be a condition that's due to me and my astrology makeup and all these other things that I can point at. But I had a great experience as I was going around collecting for Big Brothers, Big Sisters a couple weeks ago. You know, thank you for your donation. Mm-hmm. And watching people, like, I don't ask people for money generally. Like, it's very hard for me. And it's just in doing that exercise for two weekends, really massaged something in me to say people are happy to give. And they say in society that those who have the least give the most per percentage, that the 99%, those of us are more eager to give a couple of bucks that we have to a cause that we feel related to than the most wealthy people doing their philanthropy by percentage wise for income. Mm-hmm. Like, folks were like, well, I got a dollar, or I got, how much do you want? Like, they were looking at me and I would go into a business and they're like, well, what do you really want? I'm like, you got a business. I don't know, $20. Like, I'm like, $20 is the general, you know, donation, because in our economy, 20's like, really, it's not that much anymore. Yeah, it's just really, it was really heartwarming to me. The other thing I wanted to bring into this exact part of the conversation is Dharma and the idea of, I'll just read this definition here from the Oxford Dictionary. The eternal and inherent nature of reality, regarded in Hinduism as a cosmic law underlying right behavior and social order. And I think a lot about my personal dharma. Like, what is my living prayer? My work should be an extension of my purpose on the planet. And my whole life has been a whittling down of consumption, of doing jobs that would put pollution into the world. When I worked at a dispensary in the Bay Area, I looked up one day at all the plastic bags and all the glass jars with the logo on it, and how somebody's going to go out, smoke that, and then it's just more garbage, all the dupe tubes. And no offense, but where are we going to get to the point where, if we need to do that way, can we do it with biodegradable and reusable materials? And until that day, I'm not going to feel comfortable doing that with That's the End, working on houses and like looking at how many cans of paint and bottles of caulk and like garbage that comes to just build another house. And so anyway, I just, Dharma in a way to me is like being a living prayer. If I can stay seated in being one with the vibration of the continuation of life, then I'm praying with every breath I take.
Yes, when we are within ourselves, we are good. When we are not within ourselves, we are not evil. Wasn't that?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Good and evil, huh?
I get you. I feel like I, you know, when I started carving, it was at a time that I was building basketball courts. And so traveling the country, I would take, it would take sometimes 4 or 5 semis of wood. And I would think of what all of that looked like as a forest. And it all hit real deep, you know. So when I started carving, I thought, well, maybe this is the way that I can pray to the trees. Because, you know, I always thought about another poem of Khalil Gibran's. I don't know if it's in this book, but it says that trees are poems that the earth writes to the sky. And we cut them down to record our sorrows. And so this feeling of waste has always kind of been there. Our material and spiritual planes are not running at the same level. There's always this lag of some kind. And it does, it feels bad to change the oil in my car, but I need the car because of the way everything is set up far apart. And, you know, I feel like our greater selves want to divorce ourselves from that paradox, but there it is again. Like, can you divorce yourself from paradox as a rule? You know what I mean? We can keep going for better, but there's always going to be some kind of worse coming right up behind it. And it becomes that inner voice again every time you buy a bottle or a can. So, like you said, working consumption on that level so that you're like, okay, now I generate less trash than I used to because I'm thinking about it.
Right. Thinking about it is, I mean, that's the whole thing. Hmm. That actually is everything. The whole idea of alchemy, of making anything happen, is the dream, is the imagination, is thinking about it. And then from there, we have action. We have probably the worst results when we do things without thinking about them. And so from the seed of our consciousness, where is my consciousness, where from that thought will arise? And that comes into the work that I'm doing here on the show with self-awareness and exploration. It's a trigger word, but purity, because we've only been doing this way since, I don't know, since the ships really started going around, like, and the industrialization of, say, this continent, the deforestation that was happening in America once the colonizers arrived in the 1400s to not only build houses to be here, but to build ships to bring stuff back and forth while displacing the indigenous people who had been living in harmony with the land. So all of the bottles and the cans and the smokestacks and the paints and the wooden buildings in excess, people having multiple buildings, all of these things are really new to us within the past 500 years on this continent. It's not a way that, and if we've been existing as creatures for, you know, hundreds of thousands of years, this is one eyelash of a piece of time, like that it crust really in your is. Eye in the morning. It's like,
and it's crazy to think that in such a small amount of time, like we just celebrated our, what, 250th birthday of deciding not to pay the bills of England because they sent so much equipment, people, boats, stuff down here. We didn't want to pay for that. Just decided to like cut that bill, do our own thing. And over what, 250 years, the word immigrant is not our, it doesn't apply to us anymore, even though from the Oxford definition of immigrant, we would definitely apply. We migrated here. You know, why is it that that language is cut out?
Well, that's where you come into some of the toxicity of a certain type of prayer and a certain book that involves manifest destiny. Mm. You know, you're not an immigrant if you're a conqueror.
Mm-hmm.
You see? So people came here and they feel entitled to it because they took it by blood and force. And therefore, it is theirs now.
Right. And that's why we're having problems now with things like treason, because we tiptoed around that topic back when we were the ones committing treason.
I mean, I don't know. Again, what mean we? That's number one. I was like, we. I need you to use some I statements.
Man, talk about wandering in the weeds.
You know, we can say, yeah, exactly. That's a whole other show. It really is. So do you pray now? Do you consider yourself prayerful?
I think I catch myself in prayer sometimes. Like, when I analyze people's situations, especially when they rub me the wrong way, I try to turn it around so that I'm imagining their best situation, their best scenario. And sometimes it's hard for me because we naturally want to just hate on somebody when they piss us off. But in reality, if you can imagine what their best reality is, when you're seeing them inspired and in the flow, when you're seeing them walk down the street, everyone's greeting them, you know, and it's all happening. Sometimes we don't want that for our enemies. But you know what? I hope President Trump does something fantastic and someone pats him on the back someday. It might be too late. But, you know, those folks are just seeking some kind of strange affirmation. And it's so awkward, and they've been awkward for so long, they don't know how to reach it. You know what I mean? So as much as I might try to demonize people in my mind, I wouldn't feel bad for them if I saw them enjoy the moment.
Yes. Because that's the thing, is if we could each get what we need, we might not be so harsh.
And cruel.
Yeah. And, you know, bringing it back to the duality of the spirit self and the avatar, the body, in this society. When people say self-love and getting to know God, then we know that we are merely rising. Our souls are rising and meeting with each other outside of this etheric plane. I mean, outside of this material plane into the ether. And so how I treat you on this plane is directly connected to how our souls meet or have met before. And, you know, it's a whole process of existing, isn't it?
Well, yesterday there was a wasp going around my table, and it was on my water glass, and it was having problems because it would hold on with its back feet and try to dip its head down far enough. The water was too low, and so I stuck my finger in the water and put it a little bit on the edge of the glass. Then the wasp is drinking it. Like, that moment, you know, I don't like wasps any more than anyone else does. I don't like being stung. I don't. But I've tempered my reaction throughout time and can enjoy a moment of giving water to a wasp and then watching a bird sing, wondering if it's looking at us for a reaction the same way a musician does when they look into a crowd. Like, it's more than just you and me. It's all the little things around us. And, yeah, I had a weird magic moment with a wasp. Felt like we were, for that split second, we were like working together.
That is. We are. That wasp is out here pollinating. That wasp is working. That wasp was thirsty. That wasp is like, I'm going from flower to flower. This is my busy season. I need a sip. Can anybody help a wasp out? You know? And it's true. That bird is like, I'm about to eat that wasp. Tweet, that tweet. Wasp. You know? And we are the web. And so these walls that we build are just false, you know, partitions. You know, we have to stay rising into the ether to meet each other. Even when we're down, it's like, you were making me think of the Martin Luther King Loving Your Enemies chapter that we covered in A Knock at Midnight. Folks, you can go into Cab Radio at Linktree and check out the archives. But the Dr. King is so pertinent these days. And that's a real conversation that I had with a couple of different guests on the show. We went back and forth on that one. And how do we love our enemies? You know, and it's, we just have to go outside of what we know their deeds are and where we know that our souls all connect. You know, I'm gonna have to play a song and say bye to the people. Do you have any closing thoughts real quick?
I don't know, really. Smiling feels like a prayer to me. When I receive somebody's smile and I smile back, it's almost like I didn't try to smile. It just sucked out of me, you know. And I think that that's the most powerful prayer every day. Just seeing people's smiles really means a lot.
Yeah. So. I like seeing your smile.
Love seeing yours too.
Thank you. Yeah, I love that. Just on a sunny day, driving down the street, and I put my music on, and then I could just smile and feel the sun. And I look at people, and I'm like, I'm smiling at them, and they smiling back. Uh-huh. Wow, look at the vibe go higher.
Yeah.
You know? All right, everybody. Thanks for tuning in. You've been listening to In the Cab with Dream Queen and Travis. Look forward to seeing you and talking to you next week. Don't know who's going to be in. But if we stay with the prophet, it's going to be on pleasure. That's something else we talked about the other day, is on pleasure. Stay blessed, y'all. Love you so much. In the Cab Radio is produced by Jada White, a.k.a. Dream Queen. Original theme music produced by Baby Weekend Boys and Icky Mac the Beat Jugular. Learn more at In the Cab Radio at Linktree. Thank you so much for tuning in.